The Sumerian kings list is similar to the Egyptian kings list in the regards that they both have these rulers from the antediluvian days, that's the pre-flood time, that lived for a very long time, or were said to have lived for a very long time. Most historians reject these things out of hand. Now, I covered the Egyptian kings list in one of my previous videos not long ago, and this one I want to talk about the Sumerian kings list and the parts of it that I find the most interesting, namely the pre-flood kings, and how this has inspired guys like archaeologist Jeffrey Rose, as well as other people, and ultimately what I think about it. So strap yourselves in, we're going to Sumer. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. Going back an astronomical 241,000 years, the Sumerian kings list is considered to be less of a historical document than more of a king-making document. That is to say, it was really used by the scribes and the priests of the time to legitimize the ruler. Basically, the idea was an average person probably didn't live long enough to, you know, really remember the ruler from last time, so they weren't going to have it memorized. They certainly couldn't write it down for themselves, so they could fudge these lists. And there is some lines of evidence that show this. As a matter of fact, there are four different sources for the Sumerian kings list, and the list does change from source to source. Only one of these is mostly complete, and all of them contain discrepancies. Which would make sense if the biggest reason you were using these was to legitimize rulers as opposed to, like, actually track your history. You're going to change these things when the need arises. But there's another line of evidence that also shows that these things were more important as a king-making document than they were as a non-king-making document, as a historical document. And that is the whole fact that it contains antediluvian kings after the oldest version. The oldest version does not contain any of the antediluvian kings, but then it does pick it up after that. Now, the earliest kings on this list were all from before the Great Flood, and it says this plainly. In the very first section, it describes eight kings who lived from before the Flood, and it ends this section by saying, "Then the Flood swept over." After this, it has an interesting repeat of the first section. The list begins with, "After the kingship descended from the heaven, the kingship was in Eridug." Some people call this Eridu. In Eridug, Alumilimun became king. He ruled for 28,800 years. Aliajar ruled for 36,000 years. Two kings, they ruled for 64,800 years. Then Eridug fell, and the kingship was taken to Bad-Tabira. Now, I know my pronunciations are spot on. Eridug and Bad-Tabira, I'm perfectly pronounced these just as they did in Sumer a kajillion years ago. Actually, 20,000 or 200,000 or a kabillion years ago. It's pretty rough to say unless you read their stuff. But the fact of the matter is, they do have archaeological sites for both of these cities. And neither of them go back 200,000 years, obviously. But they do have archaeological sites associated with both of these. And we'll discuss that momentarily because it is a pretty interesting thing. But before I get to that, I want to point out something that's very interesting about this document. When the kingship bounces from city to city to city as the king moves from city to city throughout history. And when the document first starts, it says the kingship descended from heaven. And it only says this, again, one other place, and that is after the Flood. I'll read to you here. "After the Flood had swept over and the kingship had descended from heaven, the kingship was in Cush." And this doesn't happen again. Like I said, every other time the kingship moves from city to city, it's not described as having descended from heaven, only in the very beginning and then again after the Flood, like there was some sort of reset button. Okay, so we can see that time was considered to be distinctly different during the Sumerian people's antediluvian kings than the time that we live in now. So let's take a look at those pre-Flood kings. Now the first is Alulim. Got it. Who was said to have reigned for some 28,800 years. Now, some sources have this at 36,000 years instead. And said to have been the first ruler of Eridug, which is also known as Eridu, the first city, and according to Sumerian history. And he was succeeded by Alijar, who ruled for either 36,000 or 72,000 years. And these were the two kings that ruled Eridug. As I mentioned, Eridug is a place, an actual archaeological site. It is one of the oldest places in the region, dating back to some 5400 BC. That's over 7,000 years ago, according to the archaeology that's been done. This is nowhere near the 241,000 years that the King's List says that the city was first built in, or first had kingship come down to, I should say. But it still is an ancient site, one of the most ancient in the region, and it's being used here in myth, kind of woven together. But how much of this was actually myth? How much of the antediluvian section is actual myth? You know, there's a text called The Lament of Eridug, and it talks about the fall of the city. The roaring storm covered it like a cloak, was spread over it like a sheet. It covered Eridug like a cloak, was spread over it like a sheet. In the city, the furious storm resounded. In Eridug, the furious storm resounded. Its voice was smothered with silence as by a gale. Its people, Eridug, was smothered in silence as by a gale. Its people, its king stayed outside his city as if it were an alien city. He wept bitter tears. Father Enki stayed outside his city as if it were an alien city. He wept bitter tears. For the sake of this harmed city, he wept bitter tears. Its lady, like a flying bird, left her city. The mother of Ima, holy dog, left her city. The divine powers of the city, the holiest divine powers, were overturned. The divine powers of the rites of the great divine powers were altered. In Eridug, everything was reduced to ruin, was wrought with confusion. The evil-bearing storm went out from the city. It swept across the land, a storm which possesses neither kindness nor malice, does not distinguish between good and evil. Subur came down like rain. It struck hard. In the city where the bright daylight used to shine forth, the day darkened. In Eridug, where bright daylight used to shine forth, the day darkened. As if the sun had set below the horizon, it turned into twilight. As if An had cursed the city, alone he destroyed it. Now, this does sound like a cataclysm of sorts. I mean, Subur, the area that it mentions being smote down almost completely, well, that was northern Mesopotamia, so that's a pretty big area to be smote down completely. And Eridug was wiped off the face of the earth, and, you know, everybody's sitting around crying about it. You'll notice Enki's a god if you're not aware of this. So it's pretty interesting. This is a very interesting account of an antediluvian city being wiped off the face of the earth by a cataclysm. But let's go ahead and return to the King's List itself, because after those two kings that ruled Eridug, the kingship is said to have moved to a different city. Then Eridug fell, and the kingship was taken to Bad Tabira. In Bad Tabira, En-Men-Luana ruled for 43,200 years. En-Men-Galana ruled for 28,800 years. Dumuzid, the shepherd, ruled for 36,000 years. Three kings, they ruled for 108,000 years. So the second city, Bad Tabira, was said to have lasted a whopping 108,000 years, clearly a lot longer than Eridug was supposed to have lasted, and obviously a lot longer than any historian is going to really entertain as any serious number. Now, one of the things that is awfully interesting about this is that there is a site associated with Bad Tabira. It's called Tel Madina, and it only dates to around 5,500 years ago, but it is considered, to my most historians in the that are familiar with the region, to be this site of Bad Tabira. And that's kind of interesting. Another thing that's interesting is all these kings that have been listed so far, and all the ones that are listed in the antediluvian kings, they're mythological figures, the gods and heroes and all that kind of stuff. The guy that Dumuzid, the shepherd, he was in Inanna's Descent to the Underworld, which is a famous story from Sumer, for those of you who've read that sort of stuff. Holy Inanna answered the demons, "Outstanding Lala follows me at my right and my left. How could I turn him over to you? Let us go on. Let us go on to the great apple tree in the cane of Kulaba." They followed her to the great apple tree in the plain of Kulaba. There was Dumuzid clothed in a magnificent garment and seated magnificently on a throne. The demon seized him there by his thighs. The seven of them poured the milk from his churns. The seven of them shook their heads like they would not let the shepherd play the pipe and the flute before her. She looked at him. It was the look of death. She spoke to him. It was the speech of anger. She shouted at him. It was the shout of heavy guilt. "How much longer? Take him away." Holy Inanna gave Dumuzid the shepherd into their hands. So as you can see, the kings were deities, and this makes it a lot easier for the average person who believed in that deity to accept the longer lifespan. I mean, it's one thing to say a god lived 1,000 years, right? So This makes a lot of sense, and to me makes me think that there is a very good chance that there is some sort of numerology or hidden information encoded in these numbers. And we'll discuss that a little bit later in the video, but I do think it's very important to point out that there are people that believe that these are legitimate numbers, that these were historically accurate, that there weren't people, that these were gods, these were aliens, these were another species of hominid, whatever. There are people that believe that these are accurate numbers. Personally, I would need a lot of evidence before I would go with something like that. Although I do find it very interesting that they do go back before the flood. That's where, to me, is where it is really where the rubber meets the road. You know, we have other situations in history. I've talked about the cargo cults before. The cargo cults were a group of people that met American soldiers during World War II. The American soldiers gave them all kinds of cool shit. Then the American soldiers left and never came back. And in the 20 years between the time that World War II ended and the anthropologists returned to those islands, a whole group of islands came up with this wacky religion that was based on American soldiers bringing them stuff. And they're like emulating American airplanes and military formations and all kinds of goofy shit. So we have a touchstone as to how people completely will just blow that myth all to hell, will blow a story all to hell and turn it into a myth in one generation. So it's very liable to me, very plausible to me that there was some kernel of truth here and that it just drastically got warped out of hand in a very short period of time. Because, we do have actual solid mention of the flood, that this was a belief that permeated the region. At any rate, we've got three more cities before the flood's over, so we should probably get into those. Then Bad Tabira fell, and the kingship was taken to Larag. In Larag, En-Sipad-Zidana ruled for 28,800 years. Holy shit. One king, he ruled for 28,800 years. Then Larag fell, and the kingship was taken to Zimbir. In Zimbir, En-Mendurana became king. He ruled for 21,000 years. One king, he ruled for 21,000 years. Then Zimbir fell, and the kingship was taken to Karapag. In Karapag, Ubaratutu became king. He ruled for 18,600 years. One king, he ruled for 18,600 years. In five cities, eight kings, they ruled for 241,200 years. Then the flood swept over. Now, I consolidated the last three cities as they each only have one king. And same thing applies. They're all mythological deities, heroes of old. For example, the last king there, Ubaratutu. You may recognize him from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is basically the Noah's Ark story from Sumer. And in that, as a matter of fact, Ubaratutu takes on the role of Noah's dad. The hearts of the great gods moved them to inflict the flood. Their father Anu uttered the oath of secrecy. Valiant Enlil was their advisor. Ninurta was their chamberlain. Anugi was their minister of canals. Ea, the clever prince, was under oath with them, so he repeated their talk to the reed house. Reed house, reed house, wall, wall, O man of Shurapak, son of Ubartutu. Tear down this house and build a small boat. Abandon wealth and seek living beings. Now, this is the type of account that would be considered mythological by most academics. Because, it is kind of out there at times, right? The years are just way off. But it does seem to have something that the entire region, indeed, entire parts of the world, share this similar type of flood myth, this similar destruction of the older civilization and replacement of it by a younger civilization that was not as good, not as cool. And this is seemingly emulated right here. So if you are somebody who's trying to pierce that veil, if you believe that there might be some validity to that idea, and you're trying to pierce that veil, this is one of the few accounts you're going to find, man. Now, Jeffrey Rose is an archaeologist who has spent most of his professional life studying the migration of early humans from Africa to Arabia, and he has a hypothesis. There was a region that he calls the Gulf Oasis that would have existed in the days before the Younger Dryas, right around 12,000 years ago, right when Plato tells us Atlantis sunk. But of course, Mr. Rose has other evidence for his hypothesis. He is an archaeologist, and we know how evidence-driven and scientific those people are. All right. Sorry, that was a cheap shot. In all honesty, he does have archaeological evidence. He's got genetic evidence. He's got weather evidence from what they projected the weather would have been like in those times. And he's also got the evidence of the topography of the region that it was submerged by the rising sea level. So he's not just making stuff up here or hanging his hat on the Sumerian Kings List, but he does use the Sumerian Kings List, in fact. In fact, he uses a lot of different ancient sources to kind of inform his position. For example, in An Introduction to Human Prehistory in Arabia, he says, "The Gulf Oasis is also the place where myth and reality collide. For Sumerian poets living along its northern shoreline, it was the garden of the gods. They portrayed the region around Bahrain as the legendary land called Dilmun. In ancient times, before a great flood dislodged their first ruling dynasty, Sumerian literature describes Dilmun as an idyllic paradise where Enki, the god of fresh water, lived underground in a home called the Apsu, from which all sweet waters spring. The Gulf Oasis may also appear in the second chapter of Genesis, where it is described as a well-watered garden at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates, fed by subterranean waters that well up to nourish the face of the land. In the Ugaritic language, a precursor of Hebrew, the word Eden refers to a place where there was an exceedingly rich water supply." And a little later he continues, "The oldest written version of this tale, Eridu Genesis, was written in Sumerian. Sumerian civilization developed from the Ubaid in southern Mesopotamia. They recorded their genealogies on clay tablets known as the King's List. Inscribed on the King's List is yet another mention of the Great Flood, said to have eradicated their founding dynasty." Now, this is of great interest to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, I believe in some sort of lost ancient civilization. I don't think they were high tech in the way that a lot of people do, but I think they were higher tech than the people that came after him for sure. I think that they had the ability to do things that were considered fairly complicated. Good with math, good with sailing, good with astronomy. And these were all skills that were, you know, a lot of people forgot. Kings and priests were destroyed in the time of the flood. That's my personal belief, and I think that we're going to find situations like that all around the ancient world. As a matter of fact, I think we do. What's really cool about this to me, on the other hand, is that we have an actual scientist entertaining these things as potentially having a kernel of truth to them, as maybe being able to inform him a little bit about the situation that he's looking into. And that's really cool, because he is, let's be clear, this is the kind of thing that a lot of people would get rocks thrown at them for. They would, "No, you're a terrible person. Why would you get into all of that crazy woo stuff of Atlantis and all of that Graham Hancock? You're a racist." And all this crazy shit that comes along with that. So it's awesome that he's over there. He's probably in kind of uncharted waters in a lot of ways. He's probably one of the few people in modern times entertaining this stuff that's got a bunch of fancy letters next to his name and access to all of this stuff that some of us have to hit paywall buttons to find. But so anyway, I think it's really cool that he's involved in all of this, and I personally think that he's on the right track. I think that it's a really good chance that area was... Now, Rose personally believes that this was the area that, like, was the original area of cultivation of crops and things like that, like the origins of, what's the word that I'm looking for? Agriculture. The origins of that farming shit. He thinks that it was right there in the Fertile Crescent in what he calls the Gulf Oasis. Personally, I think that Asia is a better chance, like Southeast Asia. I think that rice is a better candidate. As I've covered in the past, there's genetic reasons that I believe this, and that pisses off a lot of people, apparently. But anyway, having said that, I think it's pretty interesting that what we have here with these numbers now could well be something that is a lost bit of code, a lost bit of knowledge that's tucked away in there. These are all divisible by 60, which they used a base 60 system in Sumer and in Babylon. This was a, like we use a base 10, like you count to 10 and then you move your decimal point. They counted to 60, and so everything of theirs is divisible by that. There's also a reason for that base 60 system. If you look at, they cut their year up into 360 days, okay? So that also fits into that, right? That's six groups of six, which is half of 12, you know, 12 groups of, which would be 12 30-degree sections of the sky, is your zodiac. So I'm of the opinion that this is conveniently tucking away some of the astronomical knowledge that they had from before, specifically precession of the equinoxes. And if you're not aware, precession of the equinoxes is basically the counter wobble of the Earth that spins the opposite direction that the Earth does, that changes the pole star over time. It's why we have the age of Aquarius and the age of Pisces. It is why we divide the sky into 12 different constellations. The sun rises in the spring equinox into the constellation that houses that time frame. Right now we are at the end of the age of Pisces and the beginning of the age of Aquarius. Personally, I believe that that is the knowledge that is tucked away in here, that they're talking about astronomical eras. And I don't even necessarily think they're talking about time spans here as much as they're trying to like discuss different things. I do think part of this is going to be lost to us. Okay, let me be just straight up about that. I don't think we're going to be able to suss this without more literature. And last I checked, the libraries on modern day new shit coming out of Sumer is pretty slim. So I don't think we're going to find too many more texts to inform us, although we may, as history goes forward, some pop out of a rich dude's at private museum, which, by the way, as a quick aside, the oldest one of these sources for the Sumerian Kings List is known as Ur 3, and it is in the hands of a private collector, and it has really sketchy provenance. Now, I know a lot of you guys like to talk about those vases that Ben Van Kirkwick and all those other guys like to get into, but they often get attacked for having shitty provenance by the exact same people that would hold up this as proof. Well, the oldest Ur 3 doesn't contain the antediluvian kings. So if you're going to prove that the antediluvian kings didn't exist and you hold up this oldest one, and that's a way that you can say that it didn't happen. Although to me, all it is it's saying that this was originally just a king's document, and then they eventually were just like, we're going to attach this to the gods, and they used a well-believed, well-known history of the region. You can't just make up robust histories like that out of thin air. But anyway, I digress. My biggest point here is that if you watch my next video, we'll talk about this in more depth, because I'm going to dig into the whole idea of, if you read Hamlet's Mill or slogged through as much as you could, or more appropriately, most people here will probably know of Hamlet's Mill and have seen like condensed versions of it. We'll be discussing the possibility of encoded, hidden astronomical language passed down through different places all around the world. Hope to see you there. Hope you enjoyed this. If you need more information on this, I'll put some links down below. Ask questions, yell at each other politely, and I hope to see you next time.